This talk is offered by Ordinary Mind Zendo. Ordinary Mind was founded by Barry Magid, Dharma heir of Charlotte Joko Beck, and is dedicated to her vision of a psychologically minded Zen practice adapted to the needs of American students practicing in the context of their everyday lives. Our public programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
The eighth day of the 12th month has come to be commemorated as the day of Buddha's enlightenment. And certainly in Japanese Zen traditions, typically the longest, most rigorous sesshin of the year is held that week, in which students' efforts are in some way meant to recapitulate the effort or ordeal of Shakyamuni culminating on that last day. It is always a question in practices like ours, the extent to which our practice can or should be kind of recapitulation of the practice and experience of its founder. The stories that are told of Shakyamuni's life practice traditionally emphasize that he was born into a royal family, grew up amid luxury, but that the sight of old age, sickness, and death propelled him to seek liberation from those things. And that path of liberation involved leaving his wife, leaving his son, leaving the comfort and security of his home, and taking the path of a mendicant ascetic. And that his practice was one of great austerity and denial, often said to have brought him to the very brink of death before he was able to achieve his great awakening. And so there's always been the question, the extent to which we are taught or we believe that it's only through the intensest of hardship and self-denial that we can achieve realization. And I certainly have heard it said that the depth of your realization will be proportional to the intensity and pain and depth of your practice. And Shakyamuni's realization led him and his followers to maintain a life as a sangha that involved non-attachment. It meant to embody non-attachment, no fixed abode, begging for every day's food. The form of life itself reflecting impermanence and essentially portraying any life of personal attachment as well as physical attachment to any kind of security as antithetical to the way. Now, as India, as Buddhism was transplanted from India to China, I think something changes in that picture. The first patriarch, Bodhidharma, coming from India, you have the story of him and his disciple, that you have this picture, again, of great austerity and self-sacrifice. The disciple standing all night in the snow, finally having to cut off his arm to prove his the intensity of his determination, and finally being admitted for teaching by Bodhidharma. You have this same kind of picture of austerity and sacrifice being the hallmark of practice. And yet it strikes me, by the time we get to the third patriarch, all of a sudden something shifts. Third patriarch writes a poem that says, "The great way is not difficult. It just means don't get caught picking and choosing." And it has a line in it that is copied onto the scroll that we have in the other room that says, "Don't remove delusion. Don't even seek the truth." Great way is not difficult. Implies that what we're doing is finding our way to be in accord with life, not feeling that our goal is to liberate ourselves from the suffering of life. I can't imagine an Indian text saying the great way is not difficult, right? It seems like a whole different flavor, one that, at least to me, sounds very Taoist, where we have a picture of an underlying harmony or flow of life, and that our practice can bring us into accord with that. That in fact we are naturally in accord with that, but are failing to see it. And all we have to do, in a way, is to get our bearings, find our way to get back into the flow of something that we've never really left. Yeah, I think that the flavor of that is something that gets increasingly developed now in American Zen, where clearly for most people, practice means trying to find some harmony in their life and with their life. We're not practicing with a formulation that assumes that our daily life is the stuff of attachment and greed and delusion that can only be broken and left behind in order to have real liberation. We want a kind of practice that allows us to feel at home in our lives and increasingly at home in our bodies and our minds. That these things are not something we're going to try to break or master, but in somehow adapt a friendlier and more compassionate stance. Now you can look at Shakyamuni's words upon awakening where he says, in this moment I and all beings attain enlightenment together. As enunciating something about that kind of intrinsic harmony or enlightenment that suddenly has revealed itself. I like to quote the version of the story where he looks at the star and says, that's me. And I understand that in terms of the star is already perfectly manifesting its nature, its perfection. The star did not have to starve itself for 6 years in order to realize it was a star. And there's some way in which it is always available to everyone everywhere to simply see things are just as they are. Don't need fixing, improving, let alone escaping. Yet the whole tenor of early Buddhism seems to be that as long as we are tempted by attachment of any kind, we're not going to see the perfection of things. We're going to be stuck wanting things to be comfortable for ourselves, right? And so that the only way out of the trap of craving of security and pleasure is to renounce those things utterly. It's a very different sensibility, I think. And in part, one of the dilemmas of our practice and our tradition is that we like to maintain a sense, certainly in Zen, that the realization available to us today is the same as the realization of our teachers and their teachers all the way back to Shakyamuni. And yet I think that realization is in fact very much colored by the different sensibilities of the cultures in which they happened. And the realization in a culture of renunciation and asceticism, I suspect, is a very different one than the realization that occurs in a culture that says we're looking to be in harmony with life as it is. For most of us, these pictures or stories of realization become things that we strive for, measure ourselves against, compare ourselves to, and they become sort of ideals that on one hand inspire us, but all the more often become ways in which we engage in self-criticism or find ourselves inadequate or inauthentic in comparison. It's very easy to read these stories of great enlightenment and feel that anything you do or anything you experience will fall short and never be it. And certainly when you read stories of great sacrifice and asceticism, suffering, there's a way in which, again, you're never going to pay enough dues to have that kind of experience. So I think the big challenge of practice is to genuinely have your own experience. Everybody says this, and you're always told, don't put another head on top of the one you have. But it's very rare that we're actually able to do that. In a certain sense, having your own experience is a way of describing realization. Right? To really take your own experience as foundational, not in comparison to anything else whatsoever. But I think it's what we really are trying to do when we sit here. We're not sitting in a way where we're concentrating and squeezing and squeezing and trying to pass a little stool of Kensho, right? We're trying somehow to actually stay with the experience that we're having of this is me, this is my mind, this is my body. Can I genuinely leave it alone? Can I allow myself to be this? Can I find a way to put some end to endless fixing and judging and comparing and self-improvement? Can I do something as simple as counting the breath and think I'm doing it right? Take that as your challenge for Rahatsu.